Okay, we're going to take your phone calls now with Christopher Dunn right here on Coast to Coast AM, and got a few more things to talk with him about as well when we come right back. Christopher, before we take calls, tell me a little bit. Did you use a lot of computer software in order to do what you did to, you know, look at the statues and things like that?
Yeah, the program that I worked in was Canvas for Windows, which is it's a very capable graphics program that allows you to manipulate images and also allows you to define geometry using any kind of lines and shapes. It's a very, very capable program. So and it's easy to use too, but the program is not the most sophisticated graphics program. There are other programs out there that are more sophisticated with three-dimensional geometry, but I did not have three-dimensional images, so the canvas for Windows was quite adequate for the level of detail that I needed.
Isn't it amazing that we need sophisticated software to determine whether the ancients used and had high technology for what they did? It's really ironic, isn't it?
Well, I'm really happy that you pointed that out, because that is a very, very significant point to make, is that the more sophisticated we become, the more sophisticated we see the ancient Egyptians, because we didn't really have the tools to take these kind of to collect this kind of data years ago. Moreover, even though we've had it for quite a while, we don't do this kind of analysis. For instance, three-dimensional images are being taken of a broken statue near the West Bank. The reason why they're taking three-dimensional images is so that they can bring them into a graphics program and reassemble them. They number the pieces, and then they reassemble the pieces in the CAD software, the 3D CAD software, before they physically put them together. So there's no mistakes, no errors. They can just go select the pieces, and they know exactly where they go. So that is one use of them. But the other use of using the kind of technology such as three-dimensional imaging with laser scanners, or even a system like Capture 3D, which is white light imaging using targets on the subject, you can collect the three-dimensional images from the artifact, say the Ramses statue, and bring it into your 3D program and compare one side of the head to the other to determine to within what tolerance are they precise. I mean, we know that the ancient Egyptian, when we ask the question, well, were they aware of such precision? Why would they use precision? Yeah, the evidence for a high level of precision can be found in the Serapeum, in these huge granite boxes that are finished to a very, very high order of precision. That really, when I measured them or compared them to a straight edge that was within 0.2 of an inch, there was no discernible variation of the accuracy of this ancient artifact and the straight edge that I was using. So we know that, I mean, they definitely were using precision, and precision in places where it really didn't belong, such as on the Giza Plateau, on architectural elements. Why did they find it necessary to cut something to within, say, 1/1000 of an inch, when it was going to be far away from, or elevated to a height where away from any kind of close examination, it just wasn't necessary. So it does kind of speak of of a machine technology that where they were cutting these artifacts the most efficient way they knew how, the fastest way they knew how, but the machines were highly calibrated and they were capable of nothing less than what they, as far as accuracy and precision, they were capable of nothing less than what we find on the artifacts laying on the ground in Egypt.
What do you think happened to them, Christopher? Have you come up with your own theories on just what happened? Where did it go?
Well, there are two things that we could discuss. Well, one is that they were there after a cataclysm and they eroded over time. The other question is, or answer may be that, you know, just like today, we will go onto a site and take our tools with us, and then when the job's done, we take the tools away because, you know, they're not necessary anymore. Not necessary there, or they're needed on another job somewhere. But where they were taken, if they were taken away, and whether they still exist in that place, I don't know. It's a huge mystery. But people say, well, where is the evidence of machine tools in ancient Egypt? Well, the evidence is laying all over the place because you can't explain their creation any other way. You can't, and it hasn't been, people have tried to demonstrate that they can be made, that these artifacts can be made using simple stone chisels, but they always fall short. Such as like trying to demonstrate that you can build a pyramid using manpower and copper chisels and stone axes. It doesn't work. They have to resort to modern methods.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Russ, first of all, first-time caller, Clarkston, Washington. Hey, Russ, go ahead. You're on with Christopher Dunn.
Greetings, George and Christopher.
Greetings.
Hi, Russ.
I've been calling for months trying to let you know about this because I've been listening and I haven't heard any mention of it at all, and that's the cracking of Ed Leeds Skolnin's Coral Castle Code.
Uh-huh.
Jeremy Strite cracked this several years ago, and I came across it, and I've been studying it for weeks. It also ties in with the subject matter. In fact, the only point in his cracking of the code that I haven't been able to prove to myself is what I'd like to propose to your guest. A right angle that connects with the base, the center of the base of the Pyramid of Giza at a 45-degree angle, splitting the apothems, supposedly is supposed to come out to the factor of phi.
Do you understand
this?
If that's
true, then there should be something in those pyramids on each face at the factor of phi, the short end from the base up. There should be something in there. Has there been any kind of a sonic resonance study of the pyramid to see if there's any chambers in there at all?
Well, the Great Pyramid, yes.
We know there are chambers, don't we?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, right. I know there's chambers and all kinds of corridors and whatnot. And I've checked those, too. They don't go to the factor of phi or the 45-degree or 90-degree angle at a 45-degree angle.
Well, Russ, to actually address your the subject matter of Coral Castle and the, is it Jeremy Strite, the who cracked the code.
Yeah.
I was directed to his website, and I looked through it. I found it very interesting, especially the connection with Masonic symbols and Masonic temples. What I've always said, though, is, and this is my position, obviously, is that for somebody to say this is the way a person did this work, then they have to use those methods to replicate the process and naturally reproduce it. So if the code leads us to be able to move the large coral blocks that are at Coral Castle in Homestead, Florida, the way Lee Skolnin did them single-handedly, 28-ton blocks, 30-ton block, you know, a 22-ton obelisk. He did a remarkable work over the period of time that he was working on it, and moved almost 1,100 tons of coral single-handedly. It's an amazing achievement. If somebody can replicate that or be able to do that and say, this is the way Lee Scanlon did it, then I think we, you know, he would get a lot of attention, because I definitely believe that when Lee Scanlon said and that he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built, he put his money where his mouth is, and he demonstrated it. Unfortunately, he took that secret to the grave. Supposedly, he left some clues behind, and this is what people like Mr. Stride are picking up on, and myself. I think that his little booklet that's called A Buck in Every Home, which actually is a treatise on how to raise a young lady, if that's a metaphor, it may be, who knows, but it's a very unusual little book. But I think maybe there is some code in that book where he described the way he constructed his castle and lifted very large blocks of coral.
Okay.
I'd like to see Jeremy actually do the work, and then I would say definitely the code has been cracked.
There's something there. Elyria, Ohio. Hey, Mike, go ahead. You're up with us.
Good evening, George and Chris.
Hi.
Hi, Mike.
Chris, I love your perspective, sir.
Thank you.
If you could give me just a moment, George, I could run two things quickly. Just on
sure.
The theme of a pre-Egyptian civilization. We know that the cartouche above the King's Chamber's granite beams is inked, stained, and not an etched hieroglyph, and I believe could be carbon dated, since it puts forward as evidence that Khufu and his kingdom's dynasties period proves when that pyramid was supposedly built. And Chris, there are no hieroglyphs in the Great Pyramid, and at Karnak, there are hieroglyphs on everything, even at the top of pillars that aren't normally visible by people. The Osirian at Abydos with the 100-ton pink granite pillars are not adorned with hieroglyphs. And I just wondered if you had looked at this Osirian, and could it be linked to the Great Pyramid as evidence of a pre- or older Egyptian civilization?
Well, the cartouche that is in the upper so-called relieving chambers, which I don't believe that they're relieving chambers because they only hold up their own weight. But the cartouches are actually on the gabled limestone blocks that actually bear the weight on top of the King's Chamber. And it has been suggested that the Supreme Council of Antiquity carbon date the paint, but they refused to do it. For what reason, I don't know. But sometimes information can cause you to go back to the drawing board and revise your theories and opinions. So the paint that they daubed on the limestone block to make this cartouche with the name Khufu in it has not been carbon dated. If it ever will, I don't know. As far as the Osirian, I've been there. And there are no. You're absolutely right. It is. You come out of the Abydos temple, and up a rise, and then look down into this kind of. It's almost like a swimming pool with these massive, massive granite pillars, and overhanging, unusual blocks, different shapes. Multi-ton, hundreds of tons, and when you look at it and you think, this is absolutely, this definitely looks like the Valley Temple near Giza, near the Great Pyramid, but it doesn't look like a temple per se. It looks more like a building a structure, maybe for support, maybe a maybe it was constructed at an earlier time, but had a different purpose than you know, just being a decorated temple where people gather. It's my impression that you know, it wasn't built for people to gather there. So,
okay, thank you. Let's go to Kyle in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Kyle, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say what a privilege it is to listen to your show every night. And
well, thank you, Kyle. Very kind of you.
And it's an honor to speak with both of you gentlemen tonight. No problem. I was just wondering, I believe it was in the show that, George, you were on, Ancient Aliens, that they had, like, some kind of proof of, like, almost like a TV or, like, a projection system in some tombs. I was just wondering if Chris had ever heard of that or seen that, maybe.
Okay.
No, I haven't heard of that. The only electrical device that
they had a picture. I think it was. I think it was a hieroglyph picture, Chris. That that looked like they were large projection tubes. In the
yeah.
They,
you know, was that the one at the Dendera Temple? The light bulb or crux tube. Yeah. I mean, that has been interpreted as actually a symbolic symbol, as a flower, or you know, it symbolizes the universe and life in the universe. But the it definitely has the appearance of being something electrical, because you have what the device that is holding up the bulb, it looks like an insulator, but what you would actually see on our power lines today. So it's not unusual that some people look at it and say that it's a technological device. Unfortunately, we can't convince Egyptologists that it is, because technology such as we're talking about here, it didn't exist in ancient Egypt, according to their theories. So,
what's your favorite smoking gun with your research, Christopher?
Well, my favorite, I have to say that my favorite is the Ramses statues, because not just the precision and the symmetry, but also the existence of tool marks, such as the one statue at Karnak, where you have the tool marks evident on the side of the face. And that was very exciting to discover and actually capture in my viewfinder, because they resembled the same kind of tool path, if you will, the direction that a tool will take on a modern machine tool that would be cutting the shape of a face or a head. And I show an example of that also. So in my book, you have plates showing this statue with the tool marks on it, and also a CAD program, a 3D model of the tool path that we would use on a machine tool.
Christopher, when we come back, let's take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, our special guest will be Timothy Beckley, and we're going to talk a little bit about Harry Houdini and the curse of the Men in Black. That's our next Coast to Coast show. Christopher, before we take final calls, what's your next project? You've got Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. What else is out there for you?
Well, that's a good question, George. I think that's probably, if I was to write another book, I will probably direct my attention elsewhere. And I am actually heading to Peru and Bolivia with David Childress in January.
Tell David hi for us, by the way.
I will do that. And, you know, if any of your listeners want to come along, they can contact David at westclub.com, or there is a link on my activities page on my website. But the it's just a small tour that we're doing. I was down there in 2005, and we went to Machu Picchu, Ollantaytambo, Sacsayhuaman. Then finally over to Bolivia to Tiahuanaco and Pumapunku. But the there is definitely something going on there, and it's going to make for a very interesting research. And who knows, maybe another buck will come out of it. But there is some fascinating artifacts and very, very capable engineers in South America, too.
Super. Let's go to Andy in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Andy, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
How you doing, George?
Good.
Chris, my question for you was just your personal, if you have an opinion on different world ages, like how the Hopi believe that we are in, like, I believe it's the fourth age of man, and that perhaps maybe through the ending of an age into the beginning of a new age, that some of these like old tricks of the trades to build these things that make us go, you know, wow, how to do it, pass on through. Because some of this ancient technology is kind of, I mean, it's really marvelous. And my second question is, what do you think about, if you've ever heard of an old Irish rant about how they're claiming, the Irish are claiming personal responsibility for the pyramids. So they say it's a poor in place, it's as simple as that. And if they're looking for alcohol, of course, they'd rule the world.
Okay, well, your first question on ages, I think that that obviously if we look into history, ages have come and new ages have taken place, where generally associated with a different mindset or different patterns of thought, such as in philosophy and science. In the last few hundred years, it has been associated with invention. So you have the Iron Age, you know, the Industrial Revolution, the Scientific Age, obviously, and the Industrial Revolution that has changed the way people live and changed the way people think. And back to George's question earlier of me, as far as what can we learn by recognizing ancient civilizations existed, and it is to actually kind of bring it or create, or if you will, encourage a different way of thinking in terms of different cultures in the world, but also to be able to recognize technologies that may have existed in the past and try and reinvent them in the present. Now, on the as far as the Irish claiming that they built the pyramids, I think I heard a buzz about that, but I don't think it's getting much traction. Now, you know, my ancestry is Irish. My grandparents were from Ireland, and I'm from Manchester, England. So,
so you're gonna don't take credit for this now, Chris.
I'm not taking credit for it. You know, if they want to, if somebody who kissed the Blarney Stone would like to take credit for it, I don't know. But the I kind of avoid that kind of discussion in terms of taking, you know, the Egyptians are so, the Egyptians have been pretty much raped and pillaged over the years. You know, Egypt has had controlling powers, and they've been stripped of their artifacts. Some say that, well, they didn't know the value of them at the time, but that's like the Indians didn't know the value of Manhattan, you know, and sold them off for some beads. But the Egyptians are very sensitive now that not just their physical artifacts are being taken away, but their heritage is being stripped away, and credit is being given to other cultures. I think that I don't support that at all.
Okay, we now have Eric driving to Portland. How about that, Eric? We have a GPS on you.
All righty. How are you guys doing on this magical evening?
All is well. Thank you.
Very, very good. God bless you, George. You're doing us proud. I'll get real quick to what I want to say, just to be fair for the other people calling in. I find it very, very odd that the Egyptians were detailed, and we have pictures of the religious ceremonies, the burial ceremonies, the way the cultures were, even pictures of UFOs, etc. But nowhere do you find any pictures of them building, and do you find any tools. And that's kind of odd. It's like that little bit was erased or withheld. And is that something that you think was done on purpose, or it was just meant for them at that time to understand? And if a certain time ever were to come into the future again, i.e. the awakening that's going on Earth with the Indigo Children, etc., and the energy and the vibration, do you think we weren't supposed to know? And that's why there are no pictures of all of that. And when we do need it, it'll be there again?
That's a fascinating question. I mean, and I could float a speculation, and really based on post-traumatic stress. Imagine if your civilization was suddenly destroyed and your iPod no longer worked, and it's sitting on the table there, and it's never going to work because the power plants have shut down. And it's just a reminder of how great life was at one time. And basically, you just take it away and destroy it because you don't want to be reminded of it. I don't know. I mean, you know, what does happen after a catastrophe that destroys a civilization? Some of the things will survive. What happens to them then? Now, as far as a different mindset, yeah, I think it's coming in terms of social awareness and you know, these kind of studies have certainly affected me, and I think anybody who travels to Egypt and sees the evidence on the ground and gets a sense of what that culture may have looked at. You know, what we're looking at now is just the skeleton of a very highly advanced civilization. And because there are no writings, I mean, you can go to downtown and look at works of art, or look at, you know, the municipal sculptures around Chicago and other places, and I don't know any places where you see depicted machine tools, or, you know, people actually working on machines or describing them in any great detail.
Good point. Okay, let's go next to Frank in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Frank, go ahead.
Hi, guys. Great to talk to you, Chris and George.
Super.
My question is the obelisks. The obelisks in three different countries. And one is in Rome, one is in London, and one is in Washington, D.C. And these all have their own government. They all aren't under the control of the country they're in. Is there any significance, and what is the detail of the significance?
Well, I'm not sure I quite understand. The obelisks that are in London, Rome, and in New York all came from Egypt. As far as the one in Rome, it's at the Vatican, so it's controlled by the Vatican. The one in New York is in, I believe, Central Park. So as far as them being controlled by a foreign power, I think that they, I don't know who has custody of them, really. Is there a, you know, a board of trustees? Certainly the Catholic Church would have control of the one at the Vatican. And ownership, but perhaps you could flesh out a little bit more what your question on that.
Well, the Vatican has its own government. It has its own police. It has its
right.
own
banking system, everything.
Yeah, and same with London and same with Washington, D.C. It has its own centralized, just in that area where the obelisks are, like.
Oh, they're in the financial centers or the centers of power. Obviously, the money that went into or the resources that funded bringing the obelisks probably came from those particular locations, and that's where they were installed, in New York, London, Lisbon, Rome. But the Vatican obelisk, it wasn't originally at the Vatican. It was brought by the Romans much earlier. But it was moved to the Vatican by Pope Sixtus.
Okay, Frank. Go ahead, Frank. One more. Frank? Well, Frank's gone. Okay. Let's go to Ryan in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Go ahead, Ryan. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking the call, George. I'm really excited about the show. It's excellent tonight. And I just had one quick question for Christopher. Along all your journeys in Egypt, have you ever encountered any supernatural experiences or anything like that? That's pretty much all I had to ask.
All right, thank you. Anything supernatural, unusual like that, Christopher?
Well, yeah, from the time I stepped off the plane till coming back, Egypt is really an amazing place, and so I think the first thing you have to recognize when you travel there is that it's a different culture altogether. They are wonderful people. They're absolutely incredibly friendly and accommodating, and it's such a good time. The city of Cairo never sleeps, and so and Luxor is a magical place with the temples. And normally it is a holiday atmosphere, particularly when you go with a group of people, because you're on vacation and it's a magical time. As far as supernatural, I know of people who have had some experiences that are unusual. And what those experiences were related to, I really believe that there are technologies still active in Egypt, and those are acoustic technologies, in that the pyramids are in tune or in harmony with the vibrations of the planet. The civilization was, or at least the structures on the civilization, were placed in and designed in a way that was in harmony with the country, and also, I mean, there is some Robert Bavall's work that ties in the structures with the star systems. I think it's significant, particularly when you go back into ancient China, and you see that it was an art or a procedure for placing buildings according to certain stars so that they're more feng shui and in harmony with the cosmos. And you know, this kind of these kind of beliefs don't seem to fit within the Western mind of, you know, hard science, the Cartesian view, but I think there's definitely something to them, and I think there's definitely something still active in Egypt, and I know a lot of people that I've been to Egypt with that will agree with me.
Okay, let's go to Randy in Philadelphia. We've got you. Go ahead, Randy.
George.
Hi.
Peace be upon you and your guests. Is it Mr. Christopher Dunn?
Yes.
Okay. A couple quick questions. Any of your material on, say, like CD or anything like that?
There are some DVDs out where I am presenting.
Okay.
At conferences. I think you would find some of those at David Hatchett Childress Adventures Unlimited.
You don't have books on tape yet, do you, Christopher?
I don't have any books on tape, but I do believe that the publisher is going to have the Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt on Kindle eventually, or an e-book, whether it's the Kindle or the Nook or other other formats. But as far as talking books, I don't have any yet.
Not yet.
Okay, that's good. One more quick question.
Sure.
I hear you talk a lot about the blocks and the size and, you know, physicality and this and that, and how heavy they were and blah, blah, blah. And I've every material I've seen, not just you, this is not personal you, that I've seen or heard of or read of about the pyramids and those structures there, about the physicality of them. But we hear, I guess maybe they can't comment too much on it, about the sheer mathematics and intelligence that went up there. Is that sort of mathematics beyond where we are?
Well,
academically,
we know one thing, that the size, they're so big, Christopher, we don't have equipment today to be able to lift them up and move it. Thank you so much. A classic Coast to Coast show with Christopher Dunn, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.